This Dharma talk was given to the Clearway Zen Sangha by Lotus Vu. This talk is made available free of charge. More information about Clearway Zen can be found at www.clearwayzen.ca.
So good morning and good afternoon to everyone. I'm glad you're all here on a beautiful summer day. It means you're very motivated to practice. And we often forget why we practice. What is the Zen practice? What is it about? Well, the Buddha said that he taught nothing but suffering or dissatisfaction and the end of suffering. And so before we realize that there's no goal, we have to have a goal. And the goal of our Zen practice is to end our suffering, end our dissatisfaction. And before we realize that we're dissatisfied, that we're suffering, we can observe ourselves in everyday life. There's a cycle. There's a natural cycle in the world. And it exists in us and exists in the external world. Buddha calls it the four cycles of birth, aging, illness, and death in all living beings. And for non-sentient beings, we have a cycle. It's called formation, coming into form, sustaining for a while, changing and decaying, and going out of form. So these four cycles happens naturally everywhere. The problem with our suffering is that we love birth. We love, you know, the sustaining part of it, you know, the part where we can enjoy it. Like planting my garden, I love putting the seedlings in, watching it grow, enjoying the fruits of my labor at the end of summer, you know, or middle of summer when I can eat my some of my vegetable throughout the summer. And then in autumn, when the weather turns a little bit cold, they start to decay and die. And for a skilled and good gardener, they don't weep over this. They know that they need to clean up the garden, collect all the dead stuff, and compost it for the next year. So they welcome autumn and all its, I call it, death and destructions of the environment naturally. But as human beings, we have, unfortunately, a preference for the upcycle. And we don't like the cycle that doesn't serve us, right? So historians have always identified that human beings has a cycle of war and peace. Pretty violent animal. We have a cycle of building and destruction. That's inherent in human nature, as always has been. And, you know, a lot of us get very alarmed when we get into, you know, I call it the yin and yang, right? The yang cycle, where destructions and death and all the things that are happening, you know, around the world, you know, throughout history are repeating again. And we don't like that. Get very, very disturbed watching that. And what happens is that we experience suffering by aversion, by developing this aversion to the natural occurrences of things. I like this. I don't like this. And this like and dislike, this preference, desire or aversion, they're both the same thing, by the way. I call aversion negative desire. Because you want to not want this around, right? That's aversion. It's still a desire. It's just a desire that's expressed in a negative form. So that's why the Buddha says desire is suffering. Desire for something that's not here. Goal in our mind. We want to change things. We want to make something that's not here possible. And we work really hard to do that. Pour all our energy in. And sometimes they don't work. Sometimes they work. And then when things change, not to our liking, we develop aversion. Aversion to what's happened. You worry. Incessant worry. And we get disturbed. We want to change what's happening in our life. Sure. So the Buddha says, this is the cycle of suffering. We can't accept what is here. And when I mean acceptance, I don't mean that, you know, you're gonna, you know, stay in an abusive situation and put up with it. That's not how it works, right? How it works is you're accepting what's happening. So you can have the clarity to respond effectively. Just like a farmer, they can accept that the weather is unpredictable. So they would have some planning to deal with it. They can accept that they need the dead stuff, you know, at the end of summer to compost for the next year, right? So they can accept that their crops are dying at the after harvest. So we look at this natural cycle. And the acceptance brings us clarity. And with this clarity, we can be, the word they usually use is equanimous with what's happening and respond effectively. This is, if I can call it a goal, but there's no goal in Buddhism because this is all still conceptual. Mind you, all this is all pointers. But the goal of the Zen practice is to end your suffering right now. To be in this equanimous experience of being in the present. And to have that mental clarity to be able to accept everything that is here. And see reality as is. And in that way, we can respond most effectively because we're not seeing distortions of reality. And we, in that natural, I call it natural experience because it's all occurring naturally. We're just like distorting it. So what we're experiencing as a species is not natural because human beings are born present. Kids are really present. They live in the moment. They don't cling on to things very much. And then they lose it because we teach them to lose it. Right? So this natural experience, which a Buddha calls nibbana, the end of suffering, or cessation, the stopping of desire, is the goal of Buddhism. There's no Buddhism. There's no nibbana. There's no nirvana. I don't mean the band. the band was a knockoff of Buddhism. Okay. So why is it that so many Buddhist teachings don't talk about nirvana? Don't talk about nirvana. I remember growing up in Vietnam and going to chant at the temple very often with my mom, listening to Dharma talks. In the sutras, it talks about nirvana pretty often. It talks about, especially the Mahayana sutras, it talks about nirvana very, very often, nirvana, and the attainment of nirvana, and what it's like to experience it. But in the Dharma talks, I rarely hear the teachers talk about it. Even less among practitioners, because they don't think it's possible. Okay. Then that, what is the goal of Buddhism? If we can't talk about the very thing that propels the Buddha to teach. Because he found cessation, he found the end of suffering. And he devoted his entire life after that to showing people how to do that. So, growing up in a culture rich in the teachings of the Buddha and the practices, I hear people avoiding this topic. It's not possible, they say. And this is probably the biggest obstacle of the Buddhist practice. Doubt. Not a good doubt. Not the doubt that, you use to test things scientifically. The healthy doubt, you lay it on the table, you observe, you test it. Right? But this is an unhealthy doubt. And that doubt is, I don't deserve it. I don't think it has it in, I don't have it in me, That's for other special people. And that's the message that I, when I was growing up in the Vietnamese, Buddhist community, I hear that. It's for special people. Ken Sho and Stream Entry is for special people who has lifetimes and lifetimes of practice and development. Well, that didn't build well for me. I remember my past life when I was a kid, and I was a kind of a schmuck last life. But I didn't listen to that message. Because I thought, if the Buddha spent 45 years of his life trying to get people to experience nirvana, and then re-experience it and make it their normal experience. Is he doing it in vain? I mean, is he lying? Because in the text, there's a lot of his students, left, right, and center, who experienced stream entry and arahantship, right? It's almost like when you read the text, it's almost like, oh, the Buddha said something and boom, somebody becomes an arahant. It's like, when I was reading the text, I was like, that was easy. That button from Staples, I used to have one of those buttons in my office. That was easy. The Buddha just give a sermon, somebody falls over and they experience can chill, stream entry. Or even easier, some of his students who just experienced stream entry goes off and go told somebody about his talk. Okay, so this is like secondhand, and then the person falls over and has stream entry. And I was thinking, oh my god, they're dropping stream entry like flies. And this is literally all over the Buddhist text, and I thought, why is that not happening now? What's wrong with people now? Right? Why is it that when the Buddha was alive, it was so easy? And the explanation usually goes like this. because at that time people have less karma, and now we have more karma. You know, we've got mud in our eyes, not just a little bit of dust. And I thought, what? I mean, Buddha has a disciple. He was a mass serial killer. You know, he'd kill people and collect their fingers and or ears. He sew it to a chain around his neck. You know, he's got hundreds of them, you know. And Agulamara, very famous guy, you know. And he heard of the Buddha and he thought, I'm just going to go and kill this guy because he's a holy man. So probably, you know, killing him would get his energy, and that can, you know, pretty good sort of trophy for me to have. So he goes and sees the Buddha and tries to chase the Buddha down and knife him. And the Buddha just kind of gets into one of his walking meditation trance and siddhis, the special powers. I don't know how much of this is real, but yeah. And Agulamara couldn't chase him. He just kept running and he couldn't catch up. Finally, he gave up, throws down the knife and says, okay, you've got something special. You got to tell me because I can't chase you. It's obviously you're not like other people I killed before. So the Buddha turns around and gave him a sermon. And then he kneels down and he becomes an arahat. And I was like, look, if that guy has a chance, I wasn't that bad of a schmuck. Okay? And this is what I saw in the text, right? But for a lot of Buddhist practitioners now, what they have is low self-esteem and confidence, right? They don't think they can do it. It's not possible, right? I can tell you, anybody can do it. In my 15 years of teaching, and this did happen, I remember in our Kensho groupies right now, we've got 13 members. But there was a lot more people who experienced Kensho, you know, in my sort of experience of teaching. There was one lady in 2010, there was one lady, she was a divorce lawyer in town, and we had a retreat with Sensei Urik. I invited a teacher over from Winnipeg. He was with the Jodo Shinshu Temple there, and I want to introduce the Zen community here, the new Zen community here, to the different types of Buddhist practice, that Zen is not the only one, right? And that's my teacher's style. He's like, go learn here, open your horizon, you know? So I invited that teacher over there, and probably remember Sensei Uri coming over. We had a mini, you know, retreat on the weekend, and Sensei was teaching with me that retreat. And so this lady, she'd been a long time practicing member of the Insight Meditation community here. She started participating, and she invited Sensei Urik to come and stay at her house while she's you know, he's here in Regina, and she has a really beautiful house with a huge library, and so one day we were in the retreat. I was giving a talk. And suddenly she just fell over her chair and she started laughing. And she just kept laughing and laughing and laughing. And the next day, Sensei Urik came to see me and he said, you know, she was laughing all night. I was in the other room and I can hear her going, oh my God. I didn't know anything. Right? So people don't realize that these kind of experiences are happening, can happen, and it is happening, right? And it's pretty random. You don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen as long as you're practicing, right? So, you know, not everybody can show stays with me. You know, because I'm a little rough afterwards. You ask everybody from the Kensho groupies who here, you know. But, you know, again, the Zen practice is the direct method. So it gets a little bit rough before and after. Some people just randomly has it, that experience. So the thing is, if we don't talk about Nirvana, we don't talk about the end of suffering, we don't talk about the experience of end of suffering, then there's no Buddhism. Right? So it becomes you know, apparent to me that a lot of Buddhism practices now are what I call suffering management. So of course that's very useful in mental health. That's very useful for most people in everyday life, but that is not the point of Buddhism. That is not the point of his teaching. Okay? He didn't say, I teach suffering and how to manage it. He said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Okay? And then this is what I found really incredible with all my years of practice. And I've been practicing for a long time, coming up to 35 years now, you know, and 21 years post-Kensho. And I can tell you, you know, it doesn't matter the year by the it's about how fast you, how much you're practicing. Okay. So you know, I said a Kensho 21 years ago, it has nothing to do with my level of practice. Okay. So to give you context, I was a pretty dedicated practitioner. So a real nerd too, and that really helped. So I scoured the text, I scoured the teachings of the patriarchs and everyone to look for, you know, contemporary or close to contemporary experiences. And I found very few of them. I found very little. And it's very vague, and it's sort of like there's no the end. Nobody's talking about what the end looks like. Right? And it's like, what the heck? Is this a dying art? And I found it really perplexing. Right, because obviously the Buddha has an end. He talks about it, the end of suffering, right? He's very specific in his word, right? So the funny thing is, again, why is that not happening? Why is that people have stream entry or Kensho, and then they can't find the end now? They think it's not. Doubt. It's a terrible thing. not a good doubt. Doubt in yourself. So people go, I've got too much karma. I've got a lot of accumulated karma. Well, yeah, so is every one of us. If you're here, you probably have a lot of accumulated karma. You know, and the other excuse is I'm too old. Sorry, Agular Mara, I don't think he's young. He's been going around killing 100 people. I think that takes time. And he's definitely got a lot of karma. I mean, how much karma you have to be a serial killer, right? So you look at that and you go, well, again, all of these ideas, they stand in the way of our practice. All these concepts and these beliefs, they become hindrances. So what I found is that the best way to deal with these beliefs is to lay it on the table and go, I'm going to question that. I'm going to question that belief. I'm going to believe that it's not totally true. Okay? And that was my method for practice. If you can't, and if it's too solid in you, you better get somebody else to tell them you the questions to instill the doubt in you, you know? So, God, it's helpful to have a spiritual friend, you know? To have a teacher who goes, really? Points out the exceptions for you, you know? So, the way to practice is to overcome all of our obstacles. or mental obstacles. And to have faith in the Buddha's teaching. Because the whole time that I was huddling around trying to practice, you know, even after Kenshin, you know, trying to navigate, I had total faith in the Buddha's teaching, and I had total faith in my teacher's guidance. Because I know, doesn't matter how far he went, he went a lot further than me. So he knows what he's doing, right? And the Buddha has that final teaching literally everywhere in the text. So it's there. That's the map. And it's up to me to discover it, to live it, to walk it, if I dare. And of course, in our practice, we're going to encounter a lot of times that challenges our fear. That we have to plow ahead daring to go into the unknown, to go against our natural fear reaction. Because ultimately, what we're doing is swimming against the stream. Because we live in a world of suffering. We live in samsara. We live in the river of suffering, right? Of the satisfaction of desire. So, what is it that propels me to then practice, to go as far as I have and still enjoying it in the last 35 years? Well, I realized that, you know, there's lots of suffering in. At first, I experienced a lot of trauma, so that was real intense suffering. I mean, that was hell. And then afterwards, a lot of that was alleviated, and then I realized there was something called normal suffering. You know, there was something called normal suffering. I experienced it every day. Anxiety, resistance, procrastination. it's like... there was something called normal suffering. I experience it every day. And, you know, on the spectrum, it's lower on the spectrum of experience. You know, like intense suffering, it's a lot of that. And normal suffering is less of that, manageable that. But it's still suffering. And after you experience the Kensho or Nibbana, you're realizing, oh, my God, do I have to go there again? And you still have to remind yourself over and over again by re-experiencing that experience over and over again that there is a place of non-suffering, okay? There is a place of non-suffering. Because first time I can show, you know, it took me a year. I dove right back into samsara because I was starting a new office. I had a, you know, the nice, spiffy, beautiful office and business going on. And so I was pretty busy. I was driven. So I got some samsara going again for another year before I experienced the next moment of cessation. And that was when I was in the hospital. My lungs were like infected, filling, you know, I was working too hard. And I was on oxygen and I realized, oh my God, what am I doing, right? I woke up again in the hospital. You know, have my second experience of Nibbana. And I was like, I'm letting everything go. This is all of the stuff I'm carrying. It's putting stress in my body. This is not worth it. Right? So my assistant ran into the, you know, the office, the hospital, and goes, can I talk to you? I said, no. And the doctor says, the nurse says, do you want to hook a phone in here? I was like, no. I mean, this is back in 2005. They don't allow, you know, cell phones was like, you know, they don't allow really phones in the hospital. So I said no. And so for the next 7 days I spent at the hospital, it was probably the best thing that happened to me. I was meditating every day. I was present. I was taking every breath with, you know, a lot of grace, even though I was struggling with it. And I remember the respiratory therapist, she comes over and visit me every day. And she's like, For somebody who's struggling to have a breast, you're pretty happy. And the doctor and nurses were saying the same thing. You know, by the fifth or sixth day, I was hauling an oxygen bottle around, walking around the ward. And they were like, you're a pretty happy patient. You're weird. A lot of people don't realize that pain and suffering are two different things, right? You can experience a lot of illness and pain. That does not necessarily equate to suffering. I remember with that experience, when I first came into the hospital, I was struggling against it. I didn't want to be sick. I didn't want my lungs to have an infection. And I had a lot of things I wanted to do. And it was suffering. By the middle of that day, I was like, I'm too tired. I can't do this anymore. I gave up. And I woke up again. Experienced that moment of nirvana. And I was like, oh, wow. I've been in another dream for, another year. And so we have to remember that normal suffering is what we experience. Okay? And there is a place called the end of suffering. And we can go there. It's possible for each and every one of us. Let me tell you, when I was in Toronto at York University, I was doing Dokusan with this guy for like 6-7 times, and he Kensho. And surprisingly, he's a factor one psychopath, which means he's born with a brain, a psychopathic brain. And he Kensho. And I thought, oh my God, in 6 weeks. And I thought, oh my God, okay. I'm jealous a little bit. I'd still talk to Millen at that time, and it was like, okay, I better check out. Is this really possible? So I talked to Millen. Millen goes, it sounds like he's Kensho. Okay. It was scary being around him, because every time I go and do Dokusan with him, I would feel this chill, I'd feel this anxiety underneath my pit of my stomach. And I would feel that before I even found, he even confessed to me that he was a factor one psychopath. So my body reacts to it. So I was like, I don't think so. Still sentient being. So that happened. And I'm pretty sure he'll find some other teacher afterwards, because he got a glimpse of what is possible, right? He was suffering. He was suffering a lot. Brilliant guy. He's probably has an IQ of about 160. Just incredible, in terms of intelligence, and I can't even fathom what goes on in his mind. The truth is, he did the psychopathic test, and he realized he was clinical. He was on the clinical path. He was a factor one psychopath, and he told me, he says, I am not violent or anything. Of course, I don't believe him. Extremely intelligent. He reads a lot of really highly sophisticated mathematical stuff that we discussed about. And I was like, ooh, this is way over my head. Okay. And he works in AI for a subsidiary of Google. That's what he says. I do believe him in that, because he has a lot of knowledge in that. And but the short end of the stick is, he's not probably not the modern world they Agulamara, but pretty close to it. He hasn't killed 100 people, but his brain is born that way, right? Without empathy. So is this possible for everyone? I had a tremendous amount of conflict when I was seeing him every day for probably 6-7 times a week, every week. He'd come to York University, and I'd see him at the there's a room there for people to do silent prayers, and it's not a chapel, it's just one big carpeted room. And I want to make sure that there's other people around when I see him. So so I saw him there. And, you know, we'd meditate together and do Dokusen. And what I realized was that, you know, I had a lot of conflict when he confessed to me that he did, you know, when he was doing his undergraduate degree to get into medical school. And this guy did go to medical school. He was extremely intelligent. He said he volunteered in a psych lab and did a psychopathic test and he scored borderline clinical. And I was like, okay. That makes sense. of course, that's a big confession. And I realized, you know, after that, I got very conflicted. I was suspicious of you know, the way he is and that he was different from other people. I can sense it. But I became really conflicted because, you know, Zen teachings, you know, you're supposed to, you know, help people who had a lot of merits, who have done a lot of good, have good karma to come to Kensho, you know, who's done all these preparatory practice and all of that. And here's this guy that shows up, never done any of that, right? Is a clinical, you know, I call it factor one psychopath, basically is biological. And which is, you know, according to our society, is not a good thing. Right? And here he is, he can't show it in front of me. And I thought, oh my God, all of the things I've been taught, right? All the things I've been taught, which is you have to prepare yourself. You have to do all these preparatory practice. You have to let go of all your past karmas. You got to do all of that in order to experience, you know, come even close to awakening. That was out the window. So I experienced for a couple of weeks extreme cognitive dissonance. It was painful. And I had to sit on it. And then I realized, after sitting on it for a while, I woke up out of Zen. So the Zen path is there to help people, to guide people, to, you know, get people to a certain place. It's a good path. It's a good vehicle. But it doesn't naturally occur all the time like that. Okay. And that was a prime example of what happened. Okay. And so after that, my mind was like, everything is possible. Anything is possible. And then I realized why, when we become Zen teachers, we take a vow to not refuse anybody to ask us. I mean, that sucks. I'm not telling you. Don't tell everybody this. So we do have a vow in our you know, before becoming the Zen teacher, to take a precept to not refuse anyone that sincerely asks for the teaching. And so I couldn't refuse him. He was so sincere, I couldn't refuse him. And then finally, I had to hide. I was like, oh, shit. I'm just totally scared being around this guy. So you know, I got busy and, you know, he kind of stopped coming to see me. I didn't refuse him. But, you know, so all of the teachings are pointers. They're not absolutes, right? And one thing I realized is that despite the Zen path being very direct, it is not the only path. And it, you know, nature doesn't naturally always occur according to what most of the time happens, right? So there are exceptions and it happens, right? So we have to talk about Nibbana. It can happen to anybody. It can happen to anyone. All sometimes is an accident, but the more you practice, the more you're accident prone. Right? So what is the goal of the practice? The end of suffering. and it's possible for each and every one of us. Don't listen to the ones who haven't tried and failed. That's what I told the other Buddhists who says it's impossible. I said, you haven't tried and failed. Because if you haven't tried, you will definitely fail, right? So, and if you try, you're going to fail sometimes. You're going to fail lots of times. But if you keep trying, you will experience it. You just keep trying. So even in the old stories of the patriarch's teaching, there was students who basically was in the monasteries for 20, 30 years and they didn't kenjo. And eventually they did, right? Coming across the right teacher that works for them. But it can happen to anyone. It can happen to all of us. But if you don't try, it's almost a guarantee you'll fail. It's like Thomas Edison. When he invented a light bulb, they said, you failed 1,000 times. What made you kept going? He says, no, I just saw it as 1,000 steps to get to where I am right now. So this is what we're doing. The Zen practice is the same. For those who haven't experienced Kensho, it's possible for you. In my experience of teaching, it's possible. It's very possible and accessible. You gotta keep trying, though. You gotta try. And for those who have experienced Kensho, the end of suffering is possible. We'll be stuck in suffering management. There are fewer people there who got to the end of the path, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. That's because, I don't know, for some reason, a lot of people who can show it afterwards give up at some part of the way. And I tell them, don't give up. As Venerable Tithuing Vui, growing up, I love to listen to his Dharma talk. He's a great Dharma teacher. He says, on the path, there's nothing more better than diligence. So diligence is the light in our life. When we're lost and confused in samsara, diligence is what gets us through it all. So he says diligence in practice, the steadiness of our practice, is probably the most vital, important part of our going at it. And I'm going to sound like a piano teacher, but that's essentially what we need to do. And I love the Twing Bee's, phrasing of that. He usually does it in a very poetic way. He would put it in a poem, right? And what I just recited to you, there was a Napoleon in Vietnamese. So it makes it very easy for me to remember because it rhymes, it's rhythmic, it's very catchy. So that was his style of teaching the Dharma, very catchy. He puts it in all these poem forms so you remember it. As a kid, I love it. So I still remember it till today, right? But to remember it and recite it and just enjoying the verbose of it, talking about it or the poetic part of it is not the same as actually doing it. So it wasn't until many years ago I realized that what he meant. You gotta do it. And, life has many ups and downs and challenges, right? And it's the practice that sustains us and keeps us steady going through all of that. Okay, I'm gonna end it here. I think I talk too much.
This podcast is created by members of the Clearway Zen Sangha. If you enjoyed the talk and wish to show support, donation information can be found on our website, www.clearwayzen.ca. Thank you for listening.